Welcome to the Web Assist Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic, introduction to the memory usage of a Java process. Today's presenter is Ben Hartle. Ben has worked for IBM Java Technology Center since 2001. Most of the time, he has been spent working in the Level 3 support team, helping both IBM's product groups and customers get the best product work out of IBM Java implementation. At this time, I'd like to turn the presentation over to Ben.
Hello there. As you said, my name's Ben Hartle. Today I'm going to take you through how the Java Virtual Machine sits within the different operating systems' native memory implementations. So we'll cover a couple of different operating systems as examples as we go through. And as I say, when we get to the end, we'll go through any questions you have. So the Java process is just like can be described as using two different spaces. We have a process address space which it sits within, and that is divided into what is known as the Java heap and the native heap. We'll explain what the native heap is, how we interact with the native heap, what goes into there, and how things are collected from there. And should we on slide 3 now? The Java process is just like any other process running on a given operating system. It's subject to all the same limits that apply to any other application that will be sitting there. So it's subject to the addressability limits of the type of the type of operating system you're running on, be it 32-bit, be it 64-bit, or in this case, 31-bit. It's also subject to any restrictions that the operating system may apply to that model, and we'll cover what those restrictions may be as we move forward. Slide 4. So, addressability restrictions. I'm sure you're all aware that these days we have 32-bit based operating systems and 64-bit based operating systems. And any operating system running on those different types of hardware are going to have to fit within the restrictions of the addressability that's available to it. So, for 32-bit architecture system, we have up to 4 gigabytes of available memory that we can address. Say, so here, 2 to the power 32, 0, 0x0 through 0xFFF in hex, and 64-bit, 2 to the power 64, with a range up to 16 exabytes. And while I'm sure a few of you would like systems with 16 exabytes, there aren't many out there yet, but we're getting there. So yeah, that's the addressability limits that we have to work within, and we'll see how, while we have those addressability limits, they aren't quite the full range of limits that the operating systems impose upon us when we try to use these different architectures. So moving on to slide 5. That's it. The operating system restrictions prevent us from using all of that addressability. So to start with, we're going to talk about the 32-bit address space because that's the one where still the majority of applications are based. We'll cover the differences about 64-bit, but for a 32-bit operating system, or for any system, it needs to take up some of that address space. And some of that address space will be taken up by the core kernel of the operating system, so the actual thing that does all the scheduling for all your applications like that. Also be taken up by some of the runtime support libraries for that operating system. How much of this memory is taken up by the operating system varies operating system to operating system, and where from that address range, that 4 gigabytes on 32-bit address range, where it's taken from that varies with operating system to operating system. And once we've taken away from this addressable region, the operating system space, what's left we call the user space, and as we move on, I'll talk about the user space and how things sit within that and what options we have. So, some diagrams hopefully here on slide 6 that will make things a little easier to understand. So we'll take Windows as our first example. So here in the top half of this slide, we can see a diagram which represents the default 32-bit Windows memory model. Starts down 0 at the bottom and all the way through to 4 gigabytes top right-hand corner. We can see that the kernel reserves the top everything from 0x8 in hex is the address point, or the 2 gig mark, is reserved purely for the operating system to do its work. Just below that area is where Windows keeps its shared libraries. So in that space, you get things like the C runtime library, the library components which represent the GUI elements of Windows, and everything like that. Anything that's shared across different applications gets loaded into there. That leaves us with a user space running from 0 megabytes up to approximately 1.8 gig, 1.9. How much of it you get actually depends on how many shared libraries you have loaded, but it's an approximation of about 1.9 gig is a good starting point. So that's the default model for Windows. There is an option that you can pass to some of the newer version variants of Windows, especially the server variants, 2003 server edition, called the 3GB switch, the 3 gig switch. And that basically tells the kernel to only use 1 gigabyte of space rather than the 2 it reserves by default. So we can see in the diagram at the bottom here, we got the kernel space running from the 3 gig line, 0xC, through to the end of 4 gig. We still have the libraries in the middle. Unfortunately, there is no way to move the libraries from where they're loaded at the 2 gig point. But user space then, we have a 1.9 gigabyte section running from 0 through to just below the 2 gig mark. And we also get a extra gigabyte of space running from the 2 gig to the 3 gig mark in the memory model. And if you're, let's say, we'll cover how the JVM fits into that space a little later, but that can be very useful under certain circumstances. That was slide 6, the Windows model. Move on. Slide 7 covers the model on Intel 32-bit Linux, or any of the 32-bit Linux variants. Here we can see that the default model again at the top. By default, the kernel takes the top gigabyte, so from the 3 gig mark to the 4 gig mark is reserved for the kernel, giving us a contiguous user space of 3 gigabytes running from 0 through to 3. With some of the newer distros, there's also the huge memory kernel option, which is a separate compile of the Linux kernel, which effectively gives you the full 4 gigabytes to work with. It works by flipping address spaces. So there's a, it's not actually shown on the diagram, but there's a small shim up around the 4 gig point, and that is used in order for the operating system to effectively flip memory spaces. And it maintains two separate address spaces, one for the kernel and one for the application that's running. And using that, we can effectively get nearly a full 4 gigabytes for the application. So, save that. That's Linux. The default, not too dissimilar to Windows. There's a section server kernel. What is useful is there's nothing breaking up that user space. It's a single block. And say with the huge memory model, you get the full 4 gig near enough. What you do pay there is a performance overhead for when it has to flip from one memory space to the next for the kernel. So any system calls which make their way through down to the kernel level do take some extra overhead. So unfortunately, you can't get 4 gig for free, but it's not too much of a problem normally. Moving on to slide 8, we get on to AIX on 32-bit. And the memory model on AIX is a little bit different. It divides the 2 gig address space up into 16 256 megabyte sections or segments. And certain segments can be used for different things, and we can change how we use those using different options. So the absolute default, the lowest level original, would actually only give any given application one 256 meg segment. But we've moved on a lot since there, and we can now use a lot more. So starting at the top, as I said, we've got three different options here. We have and they change depending on how a environment variable is set at runtime. That is what's known as the loader control max data environment variable. From a Java perspective, you don't actually need to know what the options are for setting that most of the time, because for Java 1.4.2 and onwards, the Java launcher will set that environment variable to a suitable value depending on what size Java heap you request. So the distinctions on this diagram here are the bits in brackets above each diagram actually are the size of the Java heap you have requested, and that gives us a different memory layout depending on the variable that's set in the launcher. The first option here is for heaps smaller than about 2.3 gigabytes, 2,304 megabytes. Anything smaller than that, we will use the model shown here. And here we take the first segment, the first 256 megabytes is always reserved for the kernel. The second is reserved for the application, which is actually the actual executable, which is running that application. So for Java's case, that will normally be the JRE bin Java executable. And that's stored in the second 256 megabytes there. We then have 256 megabytes or segment 3, sorry, segment 0, segment 1, segment 2, segment 2 is for thread stacks and data that will be stored on the stack. Then starting at segment 03 and running all the way through to segment D is user space, so that gives us 2.5 gigabytes. There's a segment in starting at segment D for shared libraries, and there's another starting at segment E, which is, so the top segment, segment F, is for more shared library data. So it splits the shared library into two parts, one into the actual executable of the shared library and one into any static data which it holds. So they're divided between that top space, as you can see there. If you allocate a heap larger than 2,304 megabytes, we actually merge the shared library data together and they get mapped in lower down. You don't actually use any shared libraries with this mode, but anything gets loaded again into the application text segment that would be a shared library. And that gives us a full contiguous range of 3.25 gigabytes. So that's starting at 0x3 and running all the way through. And if you allocate a heap larger than 3,072 megabytes, it's very similar to the previous diagram in the middle, except we actually compress the stacks down as well. We don't keep a specific segment just for the thread stacks. We run the whole thing through, and thread stacks are allocated where they can within the space. So in theory on AIX, we can allocate probably the second largest application. So on Linux, with the huge memory, we get the full 4 gig to work with. On AIX, we can get 3.5 gigabytes to work with, which is pretty close. So that's a very brief introduction to the AIX memory model. It can be quite complicated sometimes, depending on if you're flipping around between the different modes. As I say, normally the JVM will pick the correct mode for you for the memory model and pick the right size. That shouldn't be a problem. Moving on to slide 9. Here we are talking about the options which can be passed to the loader control max data environment variable on AIX in case you need to change the variables manually. So as we see here, we can get the 3.5 gig with the max data equals DSA. There's actually a small mistake in this slide. The last value shouldn't read loader control max data equals 0 at DSA. It should be, it shouldn't have the DSA on the end. It should just be 0x8, I believe. I will update the slide after the presentation, and hopefully we can make that available very quickly. But anyway, so these are the options you can set for loader control, but normally you don't need to worry about these. As I said, the Java Virtual Machine Launcher will deal with those for you. We're on slide 10 now, and we've moved on. So all of those, the memory model we've just been talking about applies to the 32-bit platforms. 64-bit is coming along leaps and bounds these days. A lot more applications are 64-bit based. Don't normally need to worry about the address space implementations for 64-bit applications. We have relatively so much space that the kernel is mapped way out past anywhere that your application will sit. Shared libraries likewise, so you effectively get unlimited ranges for your applications these days. I'm sure it won't be long before people start running into the limits, but at the moment, very few people are. So, for the different platforms, we have a list here of what the maximum user space available is. So, for Windows on AMD 64, you get 8 and a bit thousand gigabytes. Windows on Itanium, we get 7 and a bit gigabyte. Linux on AMD 64, there's a 500 gigabyte limit. Linux on PPC 64, we're at 1,600 gigabytes. Linux 390, 8 exabytes. And AIX, we're at 448 petabyte. Vast amounts of memory to go at here. The lowest being Linux AMD 64, and should anybody actually start seriously start pushing the limits of that 500 gigabytes, I'm sure whatever constraints that are in place that currently limited at that will be either worked around or removed, and we'll be able to address more. But I say, I'm not aware of many people actually pushing the limits of any of these platforms at the moment. So while, as I just said, we have an awful lot of space to go at on 64-bit, there are some constraints that we need to consider. At the moment, a direct comparison for running the same 32-bit application, you can run 32-bit applications on 64-bit hardware with 64-bit operating systems normally. All of the operating systems tend to support running 32-bit applications in 64-bit operating systems. And when we do the comparison, we can see that 64-bit applications can be up to 20% slower than their 32-bit counterparts for doing exactly the same load. The reasons for this are mainly down to things like hardware and software caches being less efficient. When you make a request for memory, you end up pulling back pointers which are twice as large, which take up twice as much space in the cache, level 1 and level 2 cache for the processors. We require more space to hold what is the same information for pointers to objects, things like that. With tuning, we can tend to get that further down, especially with Java 6 now that's been released along with the WebSphere 7 platform. There is a option known as compressed references, which will use 32-bit references even in a 64-bit space, so you can work with heaps. I think it's less than 32 gigabytes, and that will actually use 32-bit pointers even for addressing 32 gig heaps, therefore giving you most of that performance back. But as I say, so while 64-bit gives us pretty much unlimited amounts of memory to work with from an application point of view at this point, there are overheads and there are things to be considered before you just make a wholesale move to 64-bit. And there are things to counter some of those, especially in the newer Java releases. I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions about that particular slide towards the end. So we'll move on for now to slide 12. This is just a quick demonstration of why object sizes get bigger when you move from 32-bit to 64-bit. If we take the very simple object that we have here at the top, it's just it has four member variables. It has a date, a string, and two ints as its member variables. We can see that the object on a 32-bit operating system, the header stays the same size. The object pointer to the date doubles in size from 32 bits to 64. Again, the pointer for the string object doubles in size. The two ints stay the same size at 32-bit, but we can see that we've gained a full 64 bits in object size for this particular object, for this very simple object, when we move 32 to 64. talked about the users, how the operating system's addressability space is divided down into, from addressability space into user space as we take things away for the operating system. Now we're going to talk about how the Java process fits within the user space and how that adds another level of constraints on how much memory is available to do various things. So, as you say here, not all of the user space is directly available to the Java application. And when I say directly available to the Java application, what I mean is that we consider the Java heap, so the heap size where the objects are written, to be the area of memory which is directly accessible to the Java application. So what we mean here is basically that you can't take the entire user space and allocate it as your Java heap. There are overheads to the Java virtual machine which require some memory from the user space before we can allocate the Java heap. So, what do we have that takes that space? We've got the Java virtual machine itself. We have backing for some particular Java objects, especially a good example are if you have GUI widgets, they need backing of space in order to share memory and to be written to the screen by the whatever windowing system you're using. And then we have a whole bunch of other things which we'll talk about which take up that space as we move on. But we effectively divide the user space into two pieces. One which we consider the Java heap, we just talked about, and the other is the native heap, which we'll be talking about as we move along from now. And the little equation in the middle here is how you work out how big your native heap is. Your native heap is what's left after you've allocated your Java heap from the user space. So available memory space is user space. You take away the Java heap. That's the native heap. So effectively, we have two memory pools, and we'll be talking about what goes into which memory pool, when, and why. I have a diagram here which shows how it all fits together and what eats into which. So on slide 14, and we have the diagram on the right-hand side is effectively the entire addressable range, the entire space. So for a 32-bit application, that will be a 4-gig space. And we've taken away the kernel space and the operating system space as it slides across the top, leaving us with the gray box, which is the user space. And we effectively divide that user space into the boxes which we have listed here. So we have the Java heap, which is where your objects are. It has to be a single contiguous piece of memory, so it's allocated very early on in the Java startup. The next section here we have is some JIT data, which is where the just-in-time compiler within the JVM stores its output code and also profiling data and things along those lines for how it generates its code. The virtual machine itself, be that sections for the debug engine within the JVM, so trace buffers, dump buffers, the bytecode tables that it uses for the interpreter. There's infrastructure to back the garbage collector, so we need some space to hold some tables for our garbage collector so we can effectively clean the Java heap when we need to. So that's the area that's set aside for the Java virtual machine. Then we need some space for any application code which uses JNI, the Java Native Interface. So when you move from Java to native C code, that tends to allocate space, and that will come out of the address space as well. And also we have the Java class libraries. So the class libraries need some space. We actually need space for the classes themselves when we load them, for the class loaders which do the loading, for any threads we have running. That's all held there implemented. We also have some of the Java class loaders make JNI calls and are backed by native memory, so things like the Java NIO direct byte buffer, and sockets will all require native buffers as well for the call to the TCP/IP stack to pass data backwards and forwards. So all of this has to fit within the user space. And over the next couple of slides, we'll be going through how especially the class, how the class libraries and the JNI code interact and consume areas of this memory and how we can look at that. So we move on to slide 15 and talk about a little bit more detail about the sections that make up that last diagram. So the resources that we need for the Java virtual machine are normally quite static. They are things that we allocate once at startup, and they hold their size for the lifetime of the JVM. And so we have things like the execution engine, the bytecode tables. All of that is one-shot. We load it once. It doesn't grow once it's allocated, something that we keep. The debug engine, again, well, we have per-thread buffers for the trace within the IBM JVM. The rest of the debug engine is relatively static, and the buffers are static, assuming that we have a constant number of threads. Bits that actually vary a little bit are the GC infrastructure. So we need space and tables to back some of the garbage collector, and that's proportional to the size of the Java heap. So the bigger the heap, the more space we need for our tables to track things on the Java heap. So that's basically what goes into the JVM virtual machine section of the native heap. The JIT compiler, that has two caches which it keeps. One is the generated code cache, and one is the profiling data cache, which it uses to determine which methods to compile at which time. The code cache is limited to 64 megabytes these days, so you have a fixed size there. It starts off as small, and it will grow over the lifetime of the application. It will limit itself at a fixed size, so we can account for how much space that will take up within the address space. And likewise, the data cache is pretty much capped as well. Now, moving on to slide 16, we can talk about JNI. So, if your application or any given application running on the Java virtual machine makes native calls, it will tend to use the native operating system's system calls to allocate memory and hopefully free that memory when it's finished with it. And that all has to come out of the native space, what's left over of the user space once we've allocated the Java heap. So the default calls for, especially for the C runtime and things derived from that, tend to be malloc, calloc, realloc, and free. They will all be used to directly allocate memory for the native section of the code that the application is running. The other thing it's important to remember are that there are certain JNI API calls which call back into the JVM, which will allocate native memory on behalf of the JNI code that's running. So those include get string chars, get primitive array, and it's important to remember that if you're making these calls, you need to remember to free that memory with the appropriate call as well. So your memory will be allocated on your behalf by the JVM, and you need to request the JVM to free that memory for you when you're finished with it. So there's release string chars, release primitive array, and other similar calls for the various. So create local reference, release local reference, things like that. So as I mentioned as we were going through the diagram and earlier, there are certain Java classes which are underpinned by a certain amount of native memory, and this has to also fit into the native heap, the address space that we have to work with. So it's possible to allocate Java objects which will also be allocating native memory to go with them because of underlying JNI code. So we have a list here, and on the left-hand side we have the Java objects, and on the right-hand side we have the various bits of native structures which tend to be allocated as a result. So we create a thread object, we get a operating system native thread with the accompanying structures that are required for a thread to execute on that particular operating system. If you create any AWT, any swing, any SWT objects for doing windowing type work, for GUIs and widgets, all of those have underlying widgets and shell objects which need to be backed by native memory in order to interact with the windowing system that you're working with, be it Windows, be it X Windows, Motif, things like that. Socket objects, again, are going to have a native socket object which directly interfaces with the TCP/IP stack for your given operating system. And to go with that, there will be a probably an inbound buffer and an outbound buffer. So all of those are basically things that you would use depending on what your application does. The next two objects we have here, class objects and class loaders, are universal. To do any Java work, you're going to have to use these to some extent, whether it's directly or whether it's just as part of how the JVM brings your application up. The class objects are backed by a number of things. There's the actual class structure, so the bytes that actually make up the class object file that is stored on disk is loaded into memory. That's broken up into things like the constant pool, which is the static variables, which are static constant variables held by the object, the method table, the method blocks. So the method table is a list of all the methods which are available to that class. The method blocks are the actual byte code, which will be interpreted, and then later on, once it's been JIT compiled, there will be the compiled code to back those method blocks. I'm going to cover some of these in a bit more detail shortly. But we also have the class loader, again, so every time that's used to load a class, that keeps certain off-heap in native memory tables, because it has to interact directly with the internals of the JVM and the execution engine, the interpreter and the JIT. It's more efficient to keep that data off the Java heap. So we have the class cache, which is a table of all the classes loaded by that particular class loader, and the constraints table, which is the inheritance model. So which classes are extensions of other classes implement given interfaces is all held off heap as well. Moving on to slide 18, we're actually going to go through a bit more detail about some of those objects we've just been talking about. We have here on 18, we have the Java Lang thread object. We're going to talk about what actually underpins that on the native side, so you can have a good understanding of why having so many threads consumes so much memory from your native space. So, the Java Lang thread, we create one of these objects on the heap. It's pretty small normally. It'll have a pointer to its runnable object. It will have a string, which is its thread name, and a couple of identifiers. But basically, it doesn't take up that much space on the Java heap. On the native side, we'll have, for a Unix environment especially, we'll have something known as the pthreadt native structure. This is the underlying thread implementation for that operating system. It will the pthreadt contains pointers to things like the native stack, which is also next here. We also keep a wrapper, a Java native sort of structure off heap, which holds pointers to the pthreadt, holds a pointer to what's known as the Java stack. So the native stack is where we execute JNI methods, anything that will be sort of normal native C code. The Java stack is where we do the JIT compile code and the byte array interpretation stack for execution. So we need to maintain two stacks, one for native code, one for Java code. And we do we insert frames to jump backwards and forwards between them as we need to when we're doing execution. But all of that takes up space. So I think the default stack sizes are listed in the Java Diagnostics Guide and the SDK guides which ship with the VM, but we're talking about anything up to 256K for native stacks on some operating systems. So we can be talking about relatively large amounts of native memory, which can add up quite quickly when we've got lots and lots of objects of that type. So here we have a quick diagram which shows the split between the native heap and the Java heap for a thread object. So on the left, we have the Java heap, the actual Java objects, things you can manipulate easily with your Java code. On the right-hand side, we have the objects which live in the native heap. So these are the underlying objects which are created by the JVM to back these objects. So we have one thread object near the middle there, and we can see that that has a one-to-one relationship with a runnable object. So that'll be the actual code which is going to execute on that thread, the method which provides the code which is going to run in that thread. One-to-many relationship with a thread group which can hold many threads. Again, that's just a relatively small Java object which is going to hold just a name and a list of threads. threads which are contained within that group. Then as we cross the Java native boundary, we can see that we have a native thread object. That'll be the pthreadt object. So there's a one-to-one relationship there. And that native thread object will hold a native stack, quite a large amount of memory. Then we have a one-to-one relationship also with a Java stack. So we'll have one of those as well. And say that's the basic makeup of a Java thread and the idea of how it's split in its content between the Java heap and the native space. Next example here, a class object. So the examples we're going to work through here quite quickly are the ones that can normally lead to consuming large amounts of memory, occasionally lead to problems with customer deployments. So these are the ones that it helps to have the best understanding of in order to how they can affect your environment and the environment you're running in. So a class object backed by another collection of native resources. We have a single class structure on the native side, which holds references to a constant pool, as I said, references to other classes, method table, which is a route to getting hold of what methods are available on that class, and then we have the method blocks, which are pointed to from the method table, which is actually either the bytecode or the opcodes, as they're known, for that method, so the actual code that will be executed, or the just-in-time compiled code, the output of the JIT compiler. So we move on to the next page. There's another diagram like last time, which makes it a little easier to describe. So slide 21. We have the class object on the Java heap with the methods. Now that has there's a class loader which loaded that class object, and class loaders can load many classes, so we have a one-to-many relationship class loader to classes. As we cross the Java native boundary down the middle, we have a one-to-one relationship with a class and a class structure. And the class structure has a one-to-one relationship with a constant pool, so a table which has references to which other classes we may need to reference, so that will have pointers off to other classes. We have a one-to-one relationship with the method table, which is the list of available methods on this class. And that will have a one-to-many relationship to a method block. Now, a method block can be one of two things. It can either point directly to the opcodes. So there'll be a one-to-one relationship with the actual Java bytecodes, which were compiled with the Java C compiler. Well, as you can see here, we have a one-to-many one-to-zero-to-many relationship for compiled code. So if the JIT compiler hasn't compiled that particular method yet, then there will be no compiled code. In this case, it is 0 to 1. So if we've, with some of the earlier JVMs, if we compiled it, we would compile it just the once, and there will be one version of that compiled code. With the newer JVMs, Java 5 and Java 6, it is actually possible that we will compile that code multiple times to different levels of optimization. So it is possible that we actually have 0 to many compiled codes, and there's actually 5 different levels of JIT compilation, so it is possible to have 5 copies of the compiled code in memory as well. Okay. So those are the default objects that we've just talked about. There were threads and classes. They're quite normal. They have a pretty fixed size, relatively, of how much native memory will be consumed for any given Java object. Threads, pretty simple. We have a stack, which, while it may grow a little bit depending on how much you allocate, it has a pretty fixed amount that it can grow to. Class loaders and classes, again, we have a relatively fixed amount of memory, even though we can have multiple compiled versions of the code, that is capped. The compiled amount of code is capped, as I said earlier, at 64 meg, so we don't actually grow that particular much. This next particular couple of slides, we're going to talk about the NIO subsystem, which came in at Java 1.4. With this, it's possible to actually allocate arbitrarily sized sections of native memory. So we have to be aware when we do this of how much native memory it's possible to consume and some of the constraints about how this native memory tends to be cleared up, freed when the objects which requested it are released, and what effects that can have on the native memory footprint of your application. So, as I said, the NIO, or the new IO subsystem, was introduced at Java 1.4, designed to provide some lower-level access to the operating system, but in giving you that lower-level access, it also gave you a few more responsibilities in understanding and managing what goes on with it. So NIO introduced a type of buffer, and there are two particular types of a buffer. There is the NIO direct buffer and NIO buffer, and there's the direct byte buffer. A byte buffer, an NIO byte buffer, is basically just a Java byte array, so an area of Java heap, normal byte array as we expect. And then there's the direct byte buffer, which is actually, rather than being on the Java heap, is a byte array off the Java heap. And part of the benefits for that is you can have the same buffer being accessed by Java code as native code if you use direct byte buffers. So if you use a direct byte buffer as your socket buffer, you don't have to copy from the native buffer to the Java buffer in order to do a read. You can save cycles and do a direct read on the same buffer that your socket, your TCP/IP stack is writing its output into the socket, from the socket into the buffer. So it improves Java I/O performance. Cases in point where it's particularly used are non-blocking I/O in WebSphere 6.0 and async I/O in WebSphere 6.1. Moving on to slide 23. So as I said, two types of byte buffer, either direct or non-direct. Direct byte buffers allow us to do native I/O on the same buffer. There are on the NIO byte buffer class, there are two static methods. There's an allocate direct and an allocate. Allocate direct will create you a direct buffer, so a native memory backed buffer of however large you ask for. And the normal byte buffer, allocated with just the allocate call, will allocate you a on Java heap byte array. So all the methods that you use to interact with these from the Java side are exactly the same, apart from the method you use to create it. And let's say allocate direct will create you a section of native memory, which you can use as basically a byte array. And likewise, allocate will create you an on Java heap byte array. Here's the example for a direct byte buffer, the diagram to match the ones we were using earlier. So there's a couple extra classes at the bottom here, which we're going to talk about shortly. But basically, you have a Java NIO byte buffer, and that will either be backed by a Java byte array for the non-direct type, or for a direct byte buffer type, it will be backed by a direct byte buffer object, which will have a one-to-one relationship with an area of native memory, which effectively is exactly the same size as whatever you asked for when you created the byte buffer. Linked with that, we have what's known as a deallocator and a cleaner. The cleaner object relies on some reference handling, which we'll talk about very shortly, which is how these things are deleted. Unfortunately, when the spec was created for direct byte buffers, there was no explicit delete call made available. There's no way to delete the native memory that backs one of these explicitly. You have to rely on the mechanism I'm shortly about to talk to, and that can lead to certain problems where this native memory is not cleared up quickly enough and can lead to out-of-memory situations. So, native heap management. So, as I said earlier, if you're doing anything on the native heap using JNI, you're likely to have allocated that space with the operating system level memory management routines, malloc, calloc, realloc, and free. Subject to the normal memory management of the operating system, so anything in the native heap is controlled that way. When we create Java objects which are backed by native resources, it uses J, JNI calls to move from the Java space into the native space and then use one of these native allocation commands to actually allocate that memory. Unless there is a specific explicit cleanup API, which some objects do have, where you can dispose of the native backing. So when you call one of those explicit cleanup APIs, it will go back to the JNI layer and probably call free or the equivalent to free for whichever type of native structure you've allocated and release the backing native memory. If there isn't an explicit cleanup call, it tends to be left to something known as finalization, which is a section of the Java specification which is available, which means that basically we will run a method when a given object is eligible for garbage collection, but before we collect it. So, finalization is used to make these cleanup calls, so you end up with native method calls within your finalizers, which will go and release the backing native memory. So now we need to talk a little bit about how reference handling is done so we can understand finalization, to understand how these objects are cleaned up. So we're going to take the direct byte buffer as the example to work through here. Its cleanup is done by something known as reference handling, which is part of how finalization works. So finalization uses reference handling to run finalizers. Direct byte buffers actually use a slightly different method, which is an attempt to fast track finalization, because there are certain constraints within finalization which say that while we guarantee that finalization will run before the Java object is collected, we don't actually guarantee that the object will ever be collected, so we don't have to run finalization. All normal available JVMs do actually run finalization. It's normally run on a single background thread with low priority. So getting CPU resources in order to run finalization can be difficult in a heavily loaded system. So the sequence is you have a garbage collection cycle, an object becomes eligible for collection, it goes on the finalizer queue, and then that single low priority background thread tries to run the finalizer before the next garbage collection cycle so we can collect that object. If the finalizer thread fails to run, then that object won't be garbage collected next cycle. And if it's something that's backed by native resources, the native resources will also not be freed because the finalizer hasn't run yet. Direct byte buffers use a very similar method, except rather than using the finalizer thread, they use some internals of the JVM in how it queues things to the finalizer thread to do the cleanup. But we're going to go through that in a little bit more detail in a moment. If you remember the diagram we had before, So we're back on slide 24 for a moment. We have a cleanup object at the bottom and a deallocator. The deallocator is an object which actually holds a native method which will call through to JNI to free the native buffer. The cleaner is a phantom reference object which points at the direct byte buffer, and we'll talk about how that works over the next couple of slides. So I'm just going to move back on to this. So we're quickly going to talk about the different reference types in order to understand phantom references and how final references work. So hopefully you're aware of how one object references another. That is considered to be a strong reference, and whenever there's a strong reference between two objects, you will not garbage collect the target object because its still reference is still available. There are four special case types of reference available within Java. So there's the final reference, a weak reference, a soft reference, and a phantom reference. Final references are very specific. They're only used for any object which has a finalizer method. They're used to track those objects when garbage collection says they're eligible for collection. It's the final reference which is used to enqueue that object onto the finalizer queue so the finalizer can be run before the next garbage collection. Weak references are used to create shortcut paths between two objects. If you have a long chain of objects and you need to access an object towards the end of that chain regularly, then it's useful to use a weak reference, so you do not need to go through the long chain of objects in order to reach the target reference. Weak references will not keep a target object alive at a garbage collection, and are only valid, they will only effectively point to an object until the next garbage collection cycle, at which point the reference is reset, and you need to follow the long path to the object again to create a new weak reference. Soft references, very similar to weak references, except they tend to be, they last a period of time after a garbage collection. So, depending on the implementation, SUNS is a certain number of milliseconds after there is no strong references to an object that a soft reference will stay alive. IBM's implementation tends to be a number of garbage collection cycles after an object would normally be eligible for collection and a soft reference would fail. For final, weak, and soft references, you can track the referenced object through those objects. So there's a get call which will return you a pointer to the target reference. Phantom references are a little different. They only track, there's no way to actually get hold of the target reference, but we'll cover that in a moment. They're only use will tell you when the target has been collected through the enqueuing mechanism. So we have a diagram here on slide 28, which hopefully makes this a little easier to understand. So we have the blue oval on the left represents the process of garbage collection. So when garbage collection kicks off, it will walk through the entire heap, find all the objects which are no longer referenced, and try to collect them. If any of those objects have a reference from the set we've just talked about, a weak, a final, a soft, or a phantom reference, then they are enqueued to a queue which was created at the same time as the reference object. So as we cycle around the loop, we do garbage collection. Garbage collection finishes and presents a list of reference objects to the reference handler thread that takes those objects and, depending on what type of reference, passes them to the relevant queue. So for an object with a finalizer, it will be placed on the finalizer queue, and the finalizer thread will then run trying to clear that queue before the next garbage collection. Soft and weak references, again, there can be multiple queues depending on how your application works, and they're being queued, and it's up to the application to decide how it wants to process that queue as see fit. Applications either tend to have a specific thread to process those queues, or tend to tax other methods that relate to the objects which have been referenced in order to do the work with the queue. And the phantom reference queue, again, similar. The bit that's slightly different is for the cleaner objects that we were talking about for direct byte buffers, they're never enqueued. They're actually executed on the reference handler thread. So that is how we shortcut finalization and other reference handling to clean up direct byte buffers. But it still means that we have to wait until the next garbage collection cycle in order to free the native memory associated with a direct byte buffer. It's been a bit of a whistle stop rip through reference handling there. Basically, there are a couple of points I wanted to make here. Finalizers and even the cleaner mechanism used to clean up direct byte buffers are the last stopgap to how you would free any native memory allocated on behalf of Java objects. Finalization has its problems in the fact that it's a single thread running low priority in the background, so there's no guarantee that you will ever get your finalizer run. So if you're allocating large amounts of native memory and relying on finalization to free it, it's very easy to get into resource-constrained type races where you can't free your native memory allocations when you're done with them quickly enough to allocate more in order to do the workload. So we've got a list of things here which basically are just trying to point out that finalization is something to be avoided under normal circumstances, because, as I said, there's no guarantees when finalizers will actually get run, but doubly so if you're using them to clean up native resources. They really are not the best way to clean them up. If possible, write your code such that you have explicit cleanup routines that you call and don't rely on finalization to do the cleanup. I think we've just got a couple more slides here. So, in summary, the amount of available memory that's usable by your Java application varies operating system to operating system, hardware to hardware. And the constraints we covered at the beginning depend on how much of that you actually get to use. It's also quite possible that, as I said, with the different types of objects which are backed by native memory, very small objects on the Java heap can hang on to very large amounts of native memory off the Java heap. This is something that you need to be particularly aware of when sizing applications. And you need to be aware of what objects you're creating which are backed by native memory and how they will consume native memory and how big you can size your Java heap to fit within your available user space. So you need to size your Java heap to allow enough native space for all of these backed objects. And thirdly, as we've just covered with the reference handling, it may take multiple garbage collection cycles to free the native memory which is backing any Java objects. You may have used it in a very short transaction, but it could take an awfully long time for that object to be processed and finalized and everything else that needs to be in order to free the native memory. So it is possible for an application which doesn't appear to be leaking on the Java heap to consume and not free its native memory that backs those and lead to resource exhaustion. That was a pretty quick tour through how the JVM tries to fit into the operating system's available native memory and a couple of the pitfalls and things you have to be aware of over that time.
And our first question comes from Herman Hubler with IBM. Please go ahead.
Hello. First of all, thanks for the great presentation. It was definitely very helpful and interesting. And would appreciate if you can help me with some questions. First of all, you said that huge memkernel on Linux removes all the kernel space and we have to pay a performance penalty. Was there some testing done how much this overhead is compared to other memory models where we have the kernel running in the process space?
Unfortunately, I'm not aware of any exact figures. I just know that there is a definite overhead. It varies very much depending on what your application is doing. So if you have an application which spends all of its time in user space, in running, doesn't make system calls down to the OS, if you're not doing any socket work, if you're not doing any file I/O, things like that, I would expect it to be quite minimal. But if you're running something like WebSphere with a large amount of network traffic and things like that, I would expect it to be more so. Unfortunately, I don't have any performance stats for that. I can definitely see if I can check with the performance team here and see if they can come up with any more, though. If you want to send me an email with that question, I'll try and get you an answer from our performance guys.
Okay, thank you. What actually surprised me to learn in this presentation was that we have kernel memory in each process itself. Is it really like this, that except for huge memory kernels, that each AX process occupies kernel memory?
It's the same physical memory. So there's the first 256 megabytes of the AX space is available. Is the kernel, and that is mapped into every process. So it's not that we have multiples of that memory.
Ah, it's mapped. Okay.
It's the same piece of memory which is just mapped into each process.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Actually, one more question, if possible, please. Namely, if we have a shared class cache, starting with JDK 1.5, we get a class cache.
Yes.
How is this handling the native memory part of the shared class cache? Because we learned that on the for each class loaded, we have a class cache in the native heap memory as well. So if the class is loaded to the shared class cache, which is a shared memory segment, not allocated to a specific process, do we still have the native part of the shared class on the local heap?
So similar to the kernel, the shared memory segment is mapped into each Java process. So you still consume the same native memory per process, but the shared class buff effectively gives you, means you don't have to have backing silicon real memory to back all of that. You only need one copy of it stored on real silicon, and everything else is mapped into everybody's Java process.
But it still occupies local memories, local process memory, or so it's in a shared memory segment?
Yeah, well, the shared memory will still be mapped into the user space for that process.
Okay. So it's just from the, so and this means if I use class caching, I need the same amount of memory as if I wouldn't work with class caches.
You need less real physical memory on the machine, and you get the performance overhead that you don't, it's, so you save physical memory, but you still need to pay the same price in per application memory. And the main benefit is the performance benefits of the class cache, that you don't have to spend the time loading the class from disk again because it's already in memory.
But it doesn't allow me to reduce my heap sizes because I use class caches.
No, your heap sizes will still have to be the same.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that's all from my side. Thanks a lot.
No problem.
And our next question comes from John Cho with IBM.
Hey, Ben. Thanks for the presentation. We are having some problem with, identifying the native memory usage. Is there any tools available?
Okay, so this area is one that is a little tricky. So the best way to actually map your native memory usage is to use the operating-specific tools that ship from either the vendor or with the Linux distros, depending on which platform you're on. So...
So how about the WebSphere on the Linux or SUSE platform?
Okay, so we use PS with a number of options to track how much native memory we're using.
Mm-hmm.
We know how big the Java heap is.
Right.
So we can sort of like take the Java heap. So one thing I didn't possibly make clear is that we allocate the entire maximum Java heap space at startup.
Right.
But we only write to however much the heap is currently expanded to.
Mm-hmm.
So you will see if you measure the difference between your virtual address space and your actual usage,
mm-hmm.
you can see that differ. So if you look at the virtual address space, you should see everything that's allocated, whether or not it's paged in or written to yet.
But you just talking about the measuring the size, right?
Yeah.
But,
we can measure the sizes of things to work out whether or not things are growing or not, to whether or not we have a leak. That's normally the first case. So the approaches to solving native memory types problems tend to be work out whether or not you actually have what looks to be a native memory leak, or whether or not you just have a sizing issue with the differences. So if things don't appear to be growing over time, it's just an exhaustion because we can't get everything in. Then that's one thing. If it looks like there's a leak, then we have to start tracking what's allocating the native memory. And that actually gets very difficult.
It is. It has been, yes.
So on Linux, especially, the tools that there are a number of different tools. In fact, Linux being Linux, everybody likes to have a go at trying to solve all of the problems. There tends to be lots of different solutions. I'm trying to remember the name of the tool we use. We've been using one or two tools on Linux, especially that the one we tend to use is a emulator. It emulates the glibc, the libcware, and effectively traps all the malloc and free calls,
mm-hmm.
and records stack traces to go with who's allocated them. It's very, very performance overhead, very high performance overhead, unfortunately, but it is the one that gives the best direct answer. Just trying to remember the name of the application. I've remembered it. It's Filegrind. It's the application on Linux that we tend to use. And if you're interested in things for other platforms on Linux, there's a command from Microsoft called UMDH, which will track very well. On AIX, we actually use the built-in debug malloc implementation. Those are the ones that come immediately to mind.
And we'll take our next question from Balaman Pini with AT&T.
Hey, this is Balaman Pini. I have two quick questions. The first one, you had shown that a 64-bit JVM is a bit slow than a 32-bit JVM.
Yep.
Is it that your advice is not to go for a 64-bit Java, go for a 32-bit Java? That's my first question.
It very much depends on your application. It's one of the things that needs to be considered very carefully. If you actually require, if your data set that you have to work on within your application, within a single instance of your application, is pushing the limits that you can fit within a 32-bit process, then 64-bit is probably the only direction you can go. If it's down to number of concurrent users and sort of like the footprint of multiple users, then the suggestion tends to be to deploy as many to scale horizontally where possible. So you limit the number of, you spread your workload such that it will fit within the 32-bit process. That way you will get more, you'll get the performance benefits from not having to pay the 64-bit overhead. And you get resilience from horizontal scaling and everything that goes with it. So that tends to be the direction. As I said, with WebSphere 7 and the latest Java 6, you can actually get most of that performance overhead back with something known as compressed references, which uses some pointer shifting to ensure that we can actually run up to about 32-bit gig in size heaps on 64-bit using 32-bit pointers.
Right.
So you get most of the performance overheads back under those circumstances.
Okay, my simple question is that I know 2^32 will be the maximum size you can go, but here I think in a 32-bit, I think IBM recommends to go to the maximum limit of 2 gig and 64-bit beyond 2 gig. Is that what I'm trying to say? That if your object needs beyond 2 gig, then go for 64 Java. If it's less than 32, less than 2 gig, then go for a 32. Is that the answer?
It depends which operating system you're on. If you can get a heap that, so as long as you can size your heap to be about 30% larger than your maximum peak in use space within a 32-bit environment, then I would say stay at 32-bit. If you can't get yourself within that, if you can't get that 30% headroom to allow the best performance from garbage collection,
okay,
then it is well worth looking at 64-bit. But as I say, you should weigh off 64-bit against horizontal scaling if possible as well.
Okay. That answers my first question. My second question is that within your Java heap, there is something called large objects allocation, and the percentage of the allocation within the Java heap, there are some ratios that have been mentioned, how the JVM gets allocated, or with the pinned objects within the JVM. The ratios that IBM recommends with your tools and the values with it, do you have any documentation on it, how to come about those ratio values within the JVM memory allocations?
Okay, so there's a couple of different things that are in that question. So there's what I'm going to make a couple of guesses about where you're going from here. So you're on Java 142, there are some we have some situations where we can't necessarily find contiguous sections of Java heap in order to allocate large objects.
Right.
That comes about from pinned and dozed objects and from things like that. So sizing that tends to be very much depends on your application. There's some tools which will help. But there's options for the JVM which we can turn on to get you counts of things like how many classes you have loaded, size things for what's known as the -XK, the K cluster, to reduce fragmentation. Pinned objects, there's not much you can really do about that. But what you can do is try and allocate a large object area. The way to size that normally is to look for how many of the objects you have loaded on your Java heap are bigger than 64K.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tech note on there's a website tech node up, or a Java tech node up, which has a tool called Class Counter. That will give you a value for the -6k option from a heap dump, but it will also sum the total of objects on your Java heap that would fall within our large object area space. And it will give you that as a size. So if you take that size and compare it to how big your maximum Java heap size is, you can use that to work out what percentage you will need at a minimum to set your large object area to. And it's probably a good idea to add on a fair bit on top of that to give yourself some float room within that space. But I would say if you're having sort of like fragmentation and large object type problems, if you can in any way move from 1.4.2 to Java 5 or beyond, all of those problems will disappear.
Okay, thanks.
As a reminder, that is star 1 to ask a question or make a comment. And we'll take our next question from Vivek Rodriguez with Bank of Montreal.
Yes, thank you for the presentation. Our operating system is Solaris Unix. And I know you didn't explicitly talk about that. Would you be able to either briefly address it or update your presentation accordingly?
I'll be honest, I was particularly focusing on the IBM's platforms. Solaris is one that we do support here within the team, but it's not an operating system I work on. I'm not aware of the intricacies of the native memory model myself. I can ask one of my team members to see if he has some details on it. That's not a problem. Is my email address available anywhere?
Mine actually should be available if you can get back to me, email me. In terms of, I know I presented it, or I provided it to the conference coordinators when I logged in.
Sorry, I'm just... So can you repeat your name, sir?
So the first name is Vivek, V-I-V-E-K.
Yep.
And the last name is Rodriguez, R-O-D-R-I-G-U-E-S. And actually the email is whatever, vivek.rodriguez@bmo.com, B-M-O.com.
Ah. Very well. I just dropped my email address into the group chat window, actually. I've not got a pen handy, but if I can find a pen and a bit of paper, if you can send me a mail...
I don't actually have access to I can't get into the conference.
Okay, so my email address is H A R D.
Okay. Sorry, give me half a second. Let me start again. Okay, go ahead.
H A R D I L L B.
B. Okay.
uk.ibm.com.
uk.ibm.com. Okay.
And if you drop me a mail, I will inquire with one of my Solaris colleagues and see if we can update the slide deck a little bit to cover the Solaris memory model.
Excellent. Thank you very much. So just to reconfirm, hardillb@uk.ibm.com.
That sounds right.
Okay. Thanks again.
Our next question comes from Ken Miller with Commerce Insurance. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Ben. Similar question to Vivek's on Solaris. What about iSeries, the i5 OS model?
Okay, so that depends which JVM you're running, I believe. Now, for 1.4.2 and before, I believe that it was actually ran native i5 OS, and the memory model is interesting because the Java heap is actually in shared memory, and the garbage collector runs as a separate process. So the i5OS JVM was developed by a very separate, specific team out in Poughkeepsie, I believe, out in Rochester. And again, not an operating system I tend to deal with. I know that for Java 5 and 6, there's a version which runs within the PACE system within i5OS.
Right, the 32-bit, the J9 technology.
Yes. The VMs which run within PACE should conform to the same memory model as AIX.
Same as AIX. Okay.
Yep. So, unfortunately, I can't help you with the intricacies of the earlier versions in the direct i5 OS VMs, but the PACE ones should all behave exactly the same as AIX.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ben.
And there are no further questions at this time.
I'll just have a quick scroll through the window here and see if there are any other questions. So there was a question from Herman, which was, yes, the 4 gigabyte limit is per process. I'm not sure whether or not the large mem kernels are available for SLES 9, unfortunately. Why the Windows memory model, why the kernel takes so much memory, unfortunately, is a question from Microsoft. I know that they've been working to reduce it. There's also something called Windows on Windows, where you can run 32-bit Windows within a 64-bit Windows environment, and the hot on all of the kernel effectively disappears, the same as the huge mem on kernel on Linux. But unfortunately, the libraries are still in the middle, cutting that 4 gig in half, meaning that you still can't get a heap larger than 2 gig because we have to allocate it all in one go. There is something called split heaps in Java 6, in IBM Java 6, which will attempt to place sections of a generational garbage model where the nursery is one side of that divide and the old or tenured heap is the other side of that divide, which can get you an effective Java heap bigger than 2 gig, but only on... actually, it should work with the 3GB switch as well. So the nursery ends up in the top half, and the tenured ends up in the lower. So you can allocate about a 1.5 gig tenured and up to about 1 gig's worth of nursery space in the gap between 2 and 3 gig. There are tools to work with native memory. The GCMV plugin for ISA will plot native memory usage for Linux and AIX using some scripts which will generate either data from PS or SVMon. It can be very useful for tracking it. As for actually working out what's actually making the allocations, as I mentioned in one of the earlier questions, you tend to have to use the OS-specific tools.
Is that all, Ben?
There's a question that's just dropped in. And about the proc file system on Linux. You can make some distinction from the status and the maps file on Linux about what's native and what's Java heap because of the way we allocate certain things. So, yes, you can. If you have a deep understanding of how the VM allocates various types of memory for various different tasks, you can use the proc versus ID maps file and the proc versus ID status file to get some idea of where those have gone. Don't think there's any more questions here in the list that I haven't touched upon, unless there's any more questions coming from the lines.
Yes, we have a question from David Yang with IBM.
Hi, I just have a question about the large object area. I understand where the large object area fits if you're using the regular Mark sweep garbage collector. Where does the large object area fit if you're using the GenCon garbage collector policy? Is there a difference?
Exactly the same, except it only fits within the tenured space, the old area.
Okay, so the large object area goes into the tenured space.
Yep. So
okay.
The way we run the copy collector within the nursery space, we get implicit compactions every time we collect. So if the object will fit in the nursery, then we will always have a gap large enough to allocate it. If it won't fit in the nursery, we'll get direct allocated into the tenured space.
Thank you.